Most of the catch was put up in salt. Originally, the anchovy salters used local sea salt from La Plum, one of several sea salt operations in the natural ponds along the Catalan coast. But in time, the salt works at the mouth of the Rhone dominated. In the 14th century, an epidemic of bubonic plague, whose delirious victims die within days in excruciating pain, swept through the continent, killing 75 million people, as much as half the population of Europe, according to some estimates. But the fishing village of Collioure was not touched, and it was widely believed that the town was immune because of the presence of huge stockpiles of salt for the anchovies. Since the time of ancient Greece, anchovies have been the most praised salted fish in the Mediterranean, and since the Middle Ages, those of Collioure have been regarded as the best salted anchovies in the world. They are smaller, leaner, more flavorful than their Atlantic cousins. In the Middle Ages, Collioure was also famous for its salted tuna and sardines. The salters were men because their strength was needed to heft the salt. Anchovy filleting was done by women because it required small fingers to rip the tiny fillets off the bones. Freshly caught anchovies were mixed in sea salt and kept for a month. Then the heads were removed and the fish cleaned with no tool other than the swift, nimble fingers of the women, who then carefully arranged the fish in barrels with alternating layers of fish and salt. There they remained with a heavy weight on top for about 3 months. The length of time depended on the size of the fish and the weather, especially the temperature. When the anchovies were ripe, the color of the meat around the bones was a deep pink, almost wine-colored, and the brine, produced by the salt melting in the juice it extracted from the fish, turned pink. Unscrupulous anchovy makers dyed their brine pink. The French crown attached such importance to the commercial potential of Collioure salted fish that the town was exempted from any salt tax. This greatly aided the local anchovy business, but it was the sort of arbitrary exception that was to make the French salt tax a political disaster. Chapter 10. The Habsburg Pickle. In Germany, the Romans had found a land of ancient salt mines. Tacitus wrote in the 1st century AD that the Germanic tribes believed the gods listened more attentively to prayers if they were uttered in a salt mine. But many of those mines had been destroyed or closed down in the warfare that followed the disintegration of Rome. As in France, the medieval church reopened them. Monasteries were often located on the sites of ancient mines so that the salt could provide revenue. Under the direction of the church, salt mining boomed in the Middle Ages in the Alpine area from Bavaria into Austria. In Bavaria, Berchtesgaden, and adjacent Reichenhall. Across the Austrian border, Hallein, Hallstatt, Ischl, and Ossey were all mining the same underground bed of salt. The Austrian part became known as the Salzkammergut, the salt motherlode, a region of salt mines below green, pine-covered mountains and deeply blue lakes. In the winter, the steep pine forests were completely white with snow, but underground the temperature in the mines remained moderate. Underground springs provided brine that could be boiled into salt crystals. Plentiful forests offered cheap energy. Reichenhall, which was still in operation in Roman times, was destroyed in the 5th century either by Attila the Hun or possibly the local supporters of Odoacer, Rome's final conqueror, the Germanic Italian who in 476 officially ended the Western Roman Empire. A century later, according to some accounts, the salt works was reconstructed. According to others, it was rebuilt 300 years later by the Archbishop of Salzburg. Next to Reichenhall was a mountain of salt. On the Bavarian side was Berchtesgaden, and across the border, on the opposite side of the same steep wooded mountain known as Dürrenberg, was the ancient Celtic salt mining site of Hallein. a medieval conflict between the archbishops of Salzburg and the Bavarians over control of the salt mines, continued for centuries, because Dürnberg Mountain contained a Salzburger mine entered on the Hallein side, and a Bavarian mine entered from Berchtesgaden. Underground, the two mines were supposedly separated by less than a half mile. But the shafts from Hallein wandered under the border, and so Salzburger miners theoretically took Bavarian salt. The first Archbishop of Salzburg had resurrected the ancient Celtic mine in the late 8th century, and with this salt revenue had built the city of Salzburg, which did not merge with Austria until 1816. Though Salzburg's territory had gold, copper, and silver, it was salt for which Salzburg repeatedly fought. The wealth from salt gave Salzburg its independence. In the 17th century, an archbishop named Wolf Dietrich tried to dominate the salt market by dramatically lowering the selling price for salt from his mines, especially Dürnberg. For a time, Dietrich made tremendous profits, some of which were used to build grand Baroque buildings in Salzburg. Bavaria retaliated by banning trade with Salzburg, and this eventually led to a salt war, a conflict which Dietrich lost. This defeat was disastrous for Dürnberg and its village of Hallein because, for a time, they were excluded from much of the regional salt trade. It was even more disastrous for Archbishop Wolf Dietrich, who was removed from his church post and, after 5 years in prison, died in 1617. The relationship between the two sides of Dürnberg Mountain was not resolved until after Salzburg became a part of Austria, when in 1829 a treaty between Bavaria and Austria allowed Austrians to mine salt up to 1 kilometer beyond their border. In exchange, 40% of mine workers had to be Bavarian, and Bavaria could fuel its pans with trees chopped on the Austrian side. Though fuel had been plentiful in the Middle Ages, after centuries of mining, procuring wood had become an important issue. In 1268, and possibly earlier, a new technique was used to mine rock salt. Instead of miners carrying chunks of rock out steep shafts in baskets slung on their backs, and then crushing the rock into salt, water was piped into a dug-out vein of rock salt. The water quickly became a dense brine, which was then piped out of the mountain to the village of Hallein, where it was boiled down into crystals over wood-burning fires. Eventually, the idea became a more sophisticated system known in the Salzkammergut as Sinkwerken. A sinkwerk was an underground work area in which the surrounding salt and clay were mixed with water in large wooden tanks. The solution then moved down wooden pipes to iron boiling pans. Hallein is a village pressed between its two sources of wealth, the rough, rock-faceted Dürnberg Mountain and the Salzach River. The Salzach is a tributary of the Danube, and the brown Danube runs, with its tentacles of tributaries, from west of Bavaria through central Europe to the Black Sea. The salt could be boiled in cylindrical molds, much as it still is in Saharan Africa, and the cylinders could be loaded in barges that traveled the Salzach to Passau, where it entered the Danube to be traded in Germany or central Europe. But much of Hallein's salt was for local use, traveling by river only to Passau, where it was packed on wagons to be sold in the region. Transporting on land was expensive because tolls were established along the roadways for wagons carrying salt. The inevitable response was a network of paths over rugged mountain passes for smugglers carrying illegal salt, which they could sell for less because they paid no tolls. Rivers were essential to central European salt works. Halle in central Germany and Lüneburg in the north, with its famous founding ham, had the advantage of the Elbe with its mouth at the North Sea port of Hamburg. In the late 14th century, the Lüneburgers built a canal, the Stechenitz Canal, to connect their salt to the Elbe. They did this not to move salt to nearby Hamburg, but to ship it to Lübeck, on a tributary to the Baltic, because Lübeck was the trading center of the Hanseatic League. In the Middle Ages, no German salt enjoyed as great an international reputation as that of Lüneburg, and the Hanseatics shipped it to the herring fisheries of southern Sweden, to Riga, to Danzig, and throughout the Baltic. At a time when the Hanseatic League was considered the guarantor of quality, Lüneburg salt was considered the Hanseatic salt. Lesser German saltworks would fraudulently mark their barrels with the word Lüneburg to obtain entry to foreign markets. The salt in Lüneburg, Halle, and other German saltworks was made by drawing the brine in buckets and carrying it to boiling sheds, where it was dumped in a huge rectangular iron pan. The pan sat on a wood-burning furnace. Blood was added, which caused a scum to rise with boiling. The scum drew impurities and was skimmed off with care. The salt maker needed to continually stir the liquid. Shortly before crystallization, beer was added to further draw impurities from the crystals, which were then placed to dry in conical baskets. With the pans in use 24 hours a day, except for a once-a-week cleaning, the entire operation required only 3 people, a master salter, an assistant, and a boy to stoke the furnace. This staff was often simply a man, his wife, and a son. It was easy for a family to go into the salt business. But in Lüneburg, the business did not remain in the family because, one by one, Hanseatic merchants bought them out and gained control of a single large saltworks. The Salzkammergut developed its own salt mining culture. St. Barbara was its patron saint, and miners observed her day, December 4th, by performing traditional dances in their own dress uniforms, which, by the 19th century, included a black wool jacket with brass buttons and epaulets, and a black velvet hat with silk buttons and a gold emblem of 2 crossed pickaxes. The Dernburg mine has 19 miles of tunneling. The main tunnel was built in 1450, but the current timber shoring is only 100 years old. The tunnels were built with 7-foot ceilings and wide enough for a man to walk through comfortably. But the pressure of the mountain's weight slowly compresses them. It was in such compressed ancient shafts that medieval miners discovered the remains of their Celtic predecessors. Today, one of the 400-year-old tunnels is only about 18 inches wide in parts. Another 17th-century tunnel is about 3 feet wide. The tunnels, shored up with timber, have walls of dark rock with white streaks of salt crystals. In some spots, the rock is spotted with fossils of shellfish and other marine life. Miners would ride on steep, smooth wooden slides, which propelled them at considerable speed down to tunnels, sometimes as far as 100 feet lower. Some of the slides are more than 350 feet long. A cable on the right side provided a brake for the practiced, gloved hands of the miners. Dernburg has been hosting visitors since at least the end of the 17th century, when tours were a special treat for elite guests of the Archbishop of Salzburg. Centuries ago, it was realized that the slides could be fun. A miner at the top and 5 or 6 guests, all hugging each other, slid down as if they were in a roller coaster car. The mine also has about 25 underground lakes for boat rides. Much of the salt of Central Europe eventually came under the control of the Habsburgs. From their beginnings in 10th century Alsace, and as their rule spread across Central Europe, the Habsburg family controlled salt mines. In 1273, a Habsburg became Rudolf I, King of Germany, who enlarged his holdings by conquering Bohemia. The Habsburgs gained control of the Danube, Silesia, Hungary, and the southern region of Poland, known as Galicia. For a time, they even had Spain and all its New World possessions, as well as the Netherlands, Naples, Sardinia, Sicily, and Venice. The Habsburgs established a salt monopoly, controlling production, transport, and wholesale trade. Bohemia, one of the wealthier regions of Europe, was saltless, an eager market for other Habsburg holdings in what is today Germany, Austria, and southern Poland. Hungary was another salt-poor region that came under Habsburg rule. In 16th century Hungary, with an economy based on the export of food, there were only four important food imports: spices, wine, herring, and salt. Much of the export of food depended on the import of salt. Pig fat was a staple for both eating and preserving other food. From the 17th century on, fat was included in wages. A high-fat diet was considered a sign of wealth, and city people luxuriated in more fat than peasants. An 1884 study showed that rural Hungarians ate an average per capita of 40 pounds of cured, salted or smoked, fat, whereas city dwellers consumed an average per person of 56 pounds of fat. This does not include the significant amount of rendered animal fat that was eaten like butter, not to mention butter itself. Cooking with melted fat rather than preserved pieces was an 18th century innovation, a refinement for the upper classes. The traditional fat was made by opening a freshly slaughtered pig and removing whole the thick outer layer of fat. This was then preserved in dry salt, after which it was smoked, except in the Great Plain, the flat grain-growing region east of the Danube, where it was air-dried. Peasants made thick soups that began by melting down pieces of this salted fat, which produced an oil for frying the rest of the soup's ingredients, and cracklings, which were sprinkled on top. Southern Poland was the site of ancient springs where, as early as 3500 BC, brine was gathered and boiled in clay pots. But gradually these springs dried up. In 1247, miners began digging in the earth to get at the rock salt that had hardened at the sources of the brine. In 1278, the Polish crown took possession of the mine, but leased its operation to a succession of entrepreneurs, which included Poles, both Jewish and Christian, French, Germans, and Italians. They made payments to the controlling monarch and offered salt at discount rates to aristocracy. At first, salt miners, often prisoners of war, were worked to death in slave conditions. Not until the 14th century, when free men began working the mines, did it become less than a death sentence. In the 16th century, the mines went deeper, and huge pulley systems powered by teams of 8 horses hoisted the salt to the surface. Horses that were brought in to work the mines spent their entire lives below ground. There are mountains in which the salt goes down very deep, particularly at Velechka and Bochnia. Here on the 5th of January, 1528, I climbed down 50 ladders in order to see for myself, and there in the depths observed workers, naked because of the heat, using iron tools to dig out a most valuable hoard of salt from these inexhaustible mines, as if it had been gold and silver. Olaus Magnus, A Description of the Northern Peoples, 1555. The Polish crown earned 1/3 of its annual revenues from the salt of these 2 mines near Krakow, Velechka and Bochnia. In 1689, the mines began offering miners daily Catholic services at their underground place of work. The miners of Velechka began carving religious figures out of rock salt. 300 feet below the surface, miners carved a chapel out of rock salt, with statues and bas-relief scenes along the floor, walls, and ceiling. They even fashioned elaborate chandeliers from salt crystals. Increasingly, the mine had visitors. In the early 17th century, as in Dernburg, the crown began to bring special guests, mostly royalty. They came to dance in ballrooms, dine in carved dining rooms, be rowed in underwater lagoons. In 1830, the Velechka Salt Mine Band, which still performs, was started because of the quality of the acoustics in the mine. The Valechka mine and that of nearby Bochnia were near the Vistula, which flowed a few miles north to Krakow and then on to Warsaw, and finally to the Baltic. Any salt with a water route to the Baltic had a huge market. But the Baltic port also meant that the coarse, dark gray rock salt of southern Poland had to compete with sea salt from France and Portugal. The Portuguese sold their Setubal salt to the Hanseatics, who sold it in Holland and Denmark. By the 16th century, cheap, white Setubal salt had also become popular in Poland and other Baltic countries. The Polish crown responded by protecting its own salt with a ban on the import of all foreign sea salt. In 1772, Poland was partitioned between Austria, Prussia, and Russia, vanished as a nation until after World War I. In acquiring the Galicia region, the Austrian Habsburgs gained control of Valechka and Bochnia. The salt of these mines was sold not only in Poland, but throughout the Habsburg Empire and in Russia. The huge nation of Russia had a considerable demand for salt, especially to preserve meat and vegetables through a long and barren winter. Salting, or corning beef in most societies, was reserved for lesser cuts, such as the brisket, which is the breast cut under the first five ribs, or the round, the toughest leg cut. But in Russia, beef was often frozen solid in the ground and sawed up with little regard for different cuts. The following recipe comes from A Gift to Young Housewives by Elena Molokovits. Molokovits and her book, which she continually revised between 1861 and 1917, poignant years wedged between the emancipation of the serfs and the communist revolution, were well known in Russian households. Solonina, salted beef. Use a towel to rub off any blood from freshly slaughtered beef. This must be done while the carcass is still warm, because the blood very quickly spoils the meat. Remove the very large bones, weight the meat, and rub it all over with salt that has been dried in the oven and mixed with saltpeter and spices. Lay out the meat on a table to cool completely. Then pack into small barrels, placing the large pieces in the middle and small half-pound pieces around the edges so as not to leave any gaps. Press the meat lightly with a pounder. Sprinkle salt, saltpeter, bay leaves, rosemary, and allspice on the bottom of the barrel and over each layer of meat as the barrel is filled. When the barrel is full, cover it with a lid, seal with tar on all sides, and keep in a warm room for 2 to 3 days, every day turning the barrel over, first on one end, then on the other. Transfer the barrel to the cold cellar and then turn it over twice a week. After 3 weeks, store the barrel on ice. Use the following proportions of salt and spices. For 1.5 poods of meat, 1 pood equals 36.113 U.S. pounds, so this is about 54 pounds, use 2.5 pounds well-dried salt, 6 zolotniki, 1 zolotnik equals about 1 U.S. teaspoon saltpeter, and 3 lots, 1 lot equals about 1/2 ounce, or a tablespoon, each coriander, marjoram, basil, bay leaf, allspice, and black pepper. Add garlic if desired. Sprinkle a little extra salt into those barrels that will be used later. The barrels must be small and made of oak, because when a barrel is unsealed and the meat is exposed to the air, it soon spoils. The barrels must be sealed all over to prevent the juice from leaking. Before salting the meat, the barrels should be soaked and disinfected. Elena Molokovits, A Gift to Young Housewives. The most common salt-cured vegetables from Alsace to the Urals were cucumbers and cabbage, pickles, and sauerkraut. The importance in Central Europe of lactic fermentation of vegetables, commonly known as pickling, is best expressed by the Lithuanians, who recognize a guardian spirit of pickling named Rogučis. In any pickling, it is crucial to prevent exposure to the air, which leads to rot rather than fermentation. This is accomplished either by careful sealing, as in the beef recipe above, or by keeping the food submerged in brine by weights. Sand is used as the weight in the following recipe. Soleni ugurtsi, salted cucumbers. Dry out very clean river sand and pass it through a fine sieve. Spread a layer of this sand, the thickness of your palm, on the bottom of a barrel. Add a layer of clean black currant leaves, dill, and horseradish cut into pieces, followed by a layer of cucumbers. Cover the cucumbers with another layer of leaves, dill, and horseradish, topped with a layer of sand. Continue in this manner until the barrel is full. The last layer over the cucumbers must be currant leaves, with sand on the very top. Prepare the brine as follows. For 1 pail of water, use 1.5 pounds of salt. Bring to a boil, cool, and cover the cucumbers completely with the brine. Replenish the brine as it evaporates. Before any kind of salting, cucumbers must be soaked for 12 to 15 hours in ice water. Helena Molokovits, a gift to young housewives. Copper ions could leach into the food from copper pans, brightening colors, especially the green of vegetables. It made pickles look beautiful, but troubled the digestion, which has little tolerance for copper. Molokovits gave this warning. Purchased cucumbers are sometimes very attractive, that is, green as a result of being prepared in an untinned copper vessel, which is extremely harmful to your health. To check whether the greenness of the cucumbers is really a result of this preparation, stick a clean steel needle into a cucumber. The needle will turn a copper color in a short time if the cucumbers have been adulterated. The amount of salt used in sauerkraut in Russia and Poland depended on the economic status of the family. Families that could afford to do so used not only salt, but seasoning, such as caraway seeds, dill, and in southern Poland, cherry leaves. In Moravia, apples and onions were added. The Moravians also added bread to speed up fermentation. In Poland, making sauerkraut was a community ritual every fall after the potato harvest. Women would slice the cabbage, scald it in hot water, and place it in barrels, sometimes in wood-lined ditches in the ground. Then men would pound it with clubs or by stamping their feet to prevent air bubbles, which could cause rot. Women then covered the cabbage with linen and lids weighted by heavy stones to make sure the vegetable remained completely submerged. An annual dance marked the occasion when the year's supply of sauerkraut had been covered. But the work was not finished. The cloth had to be periodically cleaned, mold scraped off the lids, and water added to keep the cabbage submerged for 2 weeks before it could be stored in a cellar for the entire winter. In Poland and Russia, sauerkraut was an ingredient to be used in other dishes. Whole cabbages would be included with the sliced ones because the whole pickled leaves were needed for galabki, which means pigeon but is actually cabbage stuffed with buckwheat and meat. The brine was used as a soup base. Sometimes the sauerkraut was squeezed for the juice and the cabbage pieces discarded. The Polish national dish, bigosz, is sauerkraut to which meat, bacon, pickled plums, and other fruits are added. The dish, a kind of Polish szukrut, was made in past centuries in a clearing in the forest. Hunters, generally aristocrats, would come to the clearing to add their game. Pan Tadush, a poem of rural life in Lithuania, today considered the Polish national poem, describes bigosz. The bigosz is being cooked. No words can tell the wonder of its color, taste, and smell. Mere words and rhymes are jingling sounds whose sense no city stomach really comprehends. For Lithuanian food and song, you ought to have good health and country life and sport. But bigosz, even without such sauce, is good, of vegetables curiously brewed. The basis of it is sliced sauerkraut, which, as they say, just walks into the mouth. Enclosed within a cauldron, its moist breast lies on the choicest meat in slices pressed. There it is parboiled till the heat draws out the living juices from the cauldron's spout, and all the air is fragrant with the smell. Adam Mickiewicz, Pantaloush, 1832. Chapter 11. The Leaving of Liverpool. In the list of great rivers that played essential roles in the history of salt, the Yangtze, the Nile, the Tiber, and the Po, the Elbe and the Danube, the Rhone and the Loire, a gurgling mud-bottomed waterway that flows for only 70 miles from the English Midlands to the Irish Sea has to be included. The River Mersey. The importance of the Mersey lay not in the goods it carried those few dozen miles into England, but in what it carried from England to the world. The last 3 miles of the river form a sheltered, deep-water harbor, and in 1207 King John granted permission for a town to be built there, which was called Liverpool. Originally, Liverpool was the port that connected Ireland with England, but in time it became England's most important port after London. It was the port of West Indian sugar, the port of the slave trade, the Industrial Revolution port that brought iron to coal and then shipped out steel. But before any of this, it was the port of English salt, Cheshire salt, or as it became known all over the world, Liverpool salt. When the Romans came to England in A.D. 43, they found the Britons making salt by pouring brine on hot charcoal and scraping off the crystals that formed. To the Romans, this was a sign of pitiful backwardness, and being the model imperialists, they taught these primitive locals the right way to make salt, by evaporating brine in earthen pots and then smashing the pots to expose white cakes of salt. The Romans started salt works along the entire east coast. They established London in their first year in Britain, and remembering how Ostia provided for the growth of Rome, they developed salt works in Essex to provide for what they hoped would become a major port city on the Thames. The Romans were drawn to the thick forest of northwestern England, probably for fuel, because the peat they had been using to evaporate brine on the coast was becoming scarce. In the northwest, they found a place the locals knew by the Celtic name Helath Dhu, which meant Black Pit. By the time the Romans reached this area, later known as Cheshire, it had been producing salt for centuries. The earliest evidence of salt-making in Cheshire, pottery fragments dated to 600 BC, shows that the Britons had long known the new Roman technique. The neighboring area, what is today North Wales, had silver mines. When the silver was extracted, lead remained, which the Romans used to make huge pans, some weighing more than 300 pounds, for boiling brine in Helath Dhu, the first pan-evaporated salt in England. The locals, too, learned to evaporate in lead pans, but preferred a nearby location called Helath Wen, White Pit, and, not by coincidence, this produced a whiter salt. In time, Helath Dhu acquired the Anglo-Saxon name Northwich, Northern Saltworks. Anglo-Saxons called a saltworks a witch, and any place in England where the name ends in which at one time produced salt. Helath Wen became Nantwich, and between Nantwich and Northwich was Middlewich. By the 9th century, the area by the mouth of the Mersey, Cheshire, had become an important salt-producing region. The commercial center was Chester, where, in the 11th century, the Roman-built fort was the last Saxon fortress to fall to William the Conqueror, completing the Norman conquest of England. In 1070, to crush the resistance, the Normans destroyed Chester and its saltworks, and in the decades that it took Chester to rebuild, Droitwich, south of Cheshire and Worcestershire, emerged as England's leading salt producer. Chester was on the River Dee, which had an estuary that provided a deep-water port similar to that of the Mersey. Once Liverpool was founded on the Mersey, the two towns, with their two parallel rivers only a few miles apart, were competitors until the Dee began silting up and all the trade shifted to Liverpool. For centuries, Bristol was a more important port, even a more important salt port than Liverpool. This was due not to the exportation of British salt, but to the many ships carrying imported Portuguese and French sea salt that docked there. British salt works could not provide the sea salt needed for British fisheries. Even when the English made a special high-quality salt for the cure of the best herring, a salt called white-on-white, they made it with French sea salt, dissolving the French salt in water and re-evaporating it to remove impurities. The market for salt fish proved more durable than the religious convictions that created it. Even after 1533, when Henry VIII broke with the Roman Church, a Lenten meat-eater was still subject to an array of penalties, including 3 months' imprisonment and public humiliation. By this time, the motivation was less religious than economic. The government wanted to support the fishing industry. In 1563, proposal to extend the lean days to twice a week, adding Wednesday to Friday, was supported by the argument that it would build up the fishing fleet. It took 22 years of debate, but the idea of a second fast day was finally dropped in 1585. The English people were growing weary of the fast laws, and the church adapted. The selling of permits to eat meat on fast days was becoming a profitable source of church revenue. In 1682, John Collins, an accountant to the British Royal Fishery, wrote a book called Salt and Fishery, Discourse Thereof, inspired by his 7 years at sea, from 1642 to 1649, primarily serving with the Venetian fleet fighting the Turks. During this time, he was obliged to eat badly salted meat, evidently rotting, which, he said, stunk. This experience, he said, begat in me a curiosity to pry into the nature of salt. Among his many recipes was the following for curing salmon. The recipe would still be good today, assuming a 15-year-old boy were available for long periods of jumping. Though the fish is from the Scottish Northumberland border, the salt specified, as was usually the case for curing fish, was French sea salt. The salmon cured at Berwick, as described by Benjamin Watson, merchant. 1. They are commonly caught from Lattaday, March 25th, Feast of the Annunciation when the angel came to Mary, or Michaelmas, September 29th, St. Michael's Day, either in the River Tweed or within 3 miles or less off at sea against Berwick. 2. Those caught in the upper part of the river, brought by horseback to lower part, and those on the lower part thereof on boats to Berwick, fresh. 3. Then they are laid in a paved yard where, for curing, there are ready 2 splitters and 4 washers. 4. The splitters immediately split them, beginning at the tail and continuing to the head, close by the back fin, leaving the chine of salmon on the underside, the belly intact, taking the guts clear out and the gills out of the head, without defacing the least fin, and also take out a small bone from the underside, whereby they get to the blood to wash it away. 5. Afterward the fish is put into a great tub and washed outside and inside, and scraped with a mussel shell or a thin iron like it, and from thence put into another tub of clean water where they are washed and scraped again, and from thence taken out and laid upon wooden forms, there to lie and dry for 4 hours. 6. Thence they are carried into the cellars where they are opened, or laid into a great vat or pipe with the skin side downward and covered all over with French salt and the like upon another lay, and so up to the top, and are there to remain 6 weeks, in which time, 'tis found by experience, they will be sufficiently salted. 7. Then a dried calf's skin is to be laid on at the top of the cask, with stones upon it to keep them down. Upon the removal thereof, after 40 days or thereabouts, there will appear a scum at the top about 2 inches deep, to be scummed off or taken away. 8. Then the fish is to be taken out and washed in the pickle, which being done, they are to be carefully laid into barrels, and betwixt every lay, so much salt sprinkled of the remaining melted salt in the vats, as will keep them from sticking together. And after the barrel is 1/4 full, is to be stamped or leaped upon by a youth of about 15 years old or thereabouts, being covered with a calf's skin, the like at half full, and also when quite full. 9. Then a little salt is to be laid on at the top, and so to be headed up. And then the cask is to be hooped by the cooper, and blown till it be tight. 10. Then a bunghole to be made in the middle of the barrel, about which is to be put a rough or roll of clay, to serve as a tunnel, whereby frequently to fill the barrel with the pickle that is left in the vat, which will cause the oil to swim, which ought to be frequently scummed off, and serves for greasing of wool, and thus after 10 or 12 days to be bounded up as sufficiently cured and fit for exportation. John Collins, Salt and Fishery, Discourse Thereof, 1682. Even without fish, Cheshire salt had ample uses. Crops to feed both humans and livestock could only be provided until the November harvest. The animals would then be slaughtered and salted to last until spring grasses could support a new herd. Animals were slaughtered on Martinmas, November 10th, the saint day of Martin, an austere Roman soldier in Gaul who converted to Christianity and became the patron saint of reformed drunkards. Pre-Christian religions also marked November 10th as the day on which animals were slaughtered and salted for the winter, followed by a celebration for which, if they too converted, Saint Martin could grant forgiveness. English food was extremely salted. Bacon had to be soaked before using. Take the whitest and youngest bacon, and cutting away the sward, rind, cut the collops, slabs, into thin slices. Lay them in a dish, and put hot water into them, and so let them stand an hour or two, for that will take away the extreme saltiness. Gervase Markham, The English Housewife, 1648. Vegetables were also put up in salt to be used throughout the winter, and they, too, had to be refreshed before use. John Evelyn, a notable 17th-century English scholar who argued for more vegetables and less meat, gave this recipe for preserving green beans. Take such as are fresh, young, and approaching their full growth. Put them into a strong brine of white wine vinegar and salt able to bear an egg. Cover them very close, and so will they be preserved 12 months. But a month before you use them, take out what quantity you think sufficient for your spending a quarter of a year, for so long the second pickle will keep them sound, and boil them in a skillet of fresh water till they begin to look green, as they soon will do. Then placing them one by one, to drain upon a clean, coarse napkin, range them row by row in a jar, and cover them with vinegar and what spices you please, some weight being laid upon them to keep them under the pickle. Thus you may preserve French beans, haricots, etc., the whole year about. John Evelyn, Acetaria, A Discourse of Salads, 1699. Butter was also very salty. A 1305 recipe from the estate of the Bishop of Winchester called for a pound of salt to be added for every 10 pounds of butter. This would produce a butter as salty as Roman garum. The salt was to preserve the butter rather than for taste, and numerous medieval writers gave recipes for desalting butter before using, which often entailed mixing with fresh butter. Butter has the same improbable myth of origin as cheese, that it accidentally got churned in the animal skins of Central Asian nomads. Easily spoiled in sunlight, it was a northern food. The Celts and the Vikings and their descendants, the Normans, are credited with popularizing butter in northern Europe. Southerners remained suspicious and for centuries maintained that the reason more cases of leprosy were found in the north was that northerners ate butter. Health-conscious southern clergy and noblemen, when they had to travel to northern Europe, would guard against the dreaded disease by bringing their own olive oil with them. With no refrigeration, unsalted butter quickly becomes rancid. Even the butter sold as sweet was lightly salted. The English did have a specialty called May butter, which was fresh spring butter left unsalted in the sunlight for days. The sunlight would destroy the carotene, turning the butter white, and along with the pigment would go all of its vitamin A. It would become rancid and, no doubt, smell rancid. But inexplicably, in the Middle Ages, May butter was considered a health food. In the Middle Ages, yellow flowers of various species were salted and kept in earthen pots and beaten to extract a juice to color butter that had lost its carotene. Later, after Columbus's voyages, annatto seeds were used. These seeds are still used by large American dairies, not to conceal rancid butter, but because they believe the consumer wants a consistent dark yellow color. The English passed laws against selling rancid butter. A 1396 law outlawed the use of salted yellow flours. In 1662, a butter law was passed in England to establish standards. It allowed mixing rancid butter with good and specified that butter could only be salted with fine, not coarse-grained, salt, and it had to be packed with the producer's first and last name clearly marked. To preserve butter fresh for long keeping. Make a brine as before described. Salt enough to float an egg, and keep the butter sunk in it. About the beginning of May, I caused this to be put into practice, and potted up many lumps of butter bought fresh out of the market, and they all kept sweet, fresh. John Collins, Salt and Fishery, Discourse Thereof, 1682. The church did not allow butter to be eaten on fast days because it came from cows. But it also earned enormous profits selling special dispensations to affluent people who could not bear going without butter for the 40 days of Lent. Lent aside, butter was cheap food and was more popular with the poor than the rich. Because of the heavy salting, it was available most of the year. Beginning in the 16th century, it was even included in the rations of the Royal Navy. Determined to make butter more than a luxury for a rural elite, Northern Europeans consistently tried to preserve it in salt. But getting good, properly preserved butter remained a problem until refrigeration was invented. In fact, the first experiments in refrigeration were not with fish or meat, but with everyone's favorite luxury, butter. Cheese, the more successful way to preserve milk and cream, was also a popular salted food of the poor, though only the wealthy sampled the full array of English cheeses, some 150 varieties, or at least this many were remaining in the 1970s when British cheese enthusiast Patrick Rance went on a crusade to save traditional English cheese making. Cheshire, not surprisingly, for a place with both dairy herds and saltworks, produced a great deal of cheese. Cheshire is the oldest known variety of English cheese and is thought to be more representative of a medieval English cheese than is cheddar or the blue-veined Stilton. A hard cheese, though not as hard as cheddar, it has a distinct flavor thought to come from the salty earth grazed upon by Cheshire cows. By the 17th century, the English had discovered that salted anchovies would melt into a sauce. This practice may have existed centuries earlier on the continent, but in the 17th and 18th centuries, anchovy sauces became extremely popular. Grimaud de la Reynière, a great 18th century anchovy sauce enthusiast, wrote, "When this sauce has been made well, it would make you eat an elephant." In 1668, a French writer, Pierre Gontier, stated that anchovies are put in salt in order that they may be preserved, and they become garum. Certainly, the English at the time used anchovy sauce very much like garum, a liquid of preserved fish that was added to meat and other dishes as a salty seasoning. In 18th century England, anchovy sauce became known as ketchup, catsup, or catsup. To make English ketchup, take a wide-mouthed bottle, put therein a pint of the best white wine vinegar, putting in 10 or 12 cloves of echalot, peeled and just bruised. Then take a quarter of a pint of the best Langoon white wine, boil it a little, and put it to 12 or 14 salt-cured anchovies, washed and shred, and dissolve them in the wine, and when cold, put them in the bottle. Then take a quarter of a pint more of white wine and put it in mace, ginger sliced, a few cloves, a spoonful of white pepper just bruised, and let them boil all a little. When near cold, slice in almost a whole nutmeg and some lemon peel, and likewise put in 2 or 3 spoonfuls of horseradish. Then stop it close, and for a week shake it once or twice a day. Then use it. It is good to put into fish sauce or any savory dish of meat. You may add it to clear liquor that comes from mushrooms. Eliza Smith, The Complete Housewife, Posthumous 16th Edition, 1758. Ketchup derives its name from the Indonesian fish and soy sauce ketchup ikan. The names of several other Indonesian sauces also include the word ketchup, which means a base of dark, thick soy sauce. Why would English garum have an Indonesian name? Because the English, starting with the medieval spice trade, looked to Asia for seasoning. Many English condiments, even Worcestershire sauce, invented in the 1840s, are based on Asian ideas. Whether it is called garum, anchovy sauce, or ketchup, a large dose of salt was an essential ingredient. Margaret Dodds cautioned in her 1829 London cookbook that catsups, to make them keep well, require a great deal of salt. The salt in ketchup originally came from salt-cured fish, and most early anchovy ketchup recipes, such as Eliza Smith's, do not even list salt as an ingredient because it is part of the anchovies. But the English and Americans began to move away from having fish in their ketchup. It became a mushroom sauce, a walnut sauce, or even a salted lemon sauce. These ketchups originally included salt anchovies, but as Anglo-Saxon cooking lost its boldness, cooks began to see the presence of fish as a strong flavor, limiting the usefulness of the condiment. Roman cooks would have been appalled by the lack of temerity, but Margaret Dodds adds at the end of her walnut ketchup recipe, "Anchovies, garlic, cayenne, etc. are sometimes put to this catsup, but we think this is a bad method, as these flavors may render it unsuitable for some dishes, and they can be added extempore when required." Margaret Dodds, Cook and Housewife's Manual, London, 1829. Ketchup became a tomato sauce, originally called tomato ketchup in America, which is appropriate since the tomato is an American plant, brought to Europe by Hernan Cortes, embraced in the Mediterranean, and regarded with great suspicion in the North. The first known recipe for tomato ketchup was by a New Jersey resident. All that is certain about the date is that it had to be before 1782, the year his unfashionable loyalty to the British crown forced him to flee to Nova Scotia. The first published recipe for tomato ketchup appeared in 1812, written by a prominent Philadelphia physician and horticulturist, James Mees. Already in 1804, he had observed, employing the term used for tomatoes in the United States at the time, that love apples make a fine catsup. Mees said that the condiment was frequently used by the French. The French have never been known for their fondness for tomato ketchup, so it is thought, given the date, that the French he was referring to were planter refugees from the Haitian Revolution. To this day, a tomato sauce is commonly used in Haiti and referred to as sauce creole. Love apple catsup. Slice the apples thin, and over every layer sprinkle a little salt. Cover them, and let them lie 24 hours. Then beat them well and simmer them half an hour in a bell metal kettle. Add mace and allspice. When cold, add 2 cloves of raw shallots, cut small, and 1/2 gill of brandy to each bottle, which must be corked tight and kept in a cool place. James Mees, Archives of Useful Knowledge, Philadelphia, 1812. Ketchup remained a salted product. Lydia Maria Child, in her 1829 Boston cookbook, The American Frugal Housewife, advised in making tomato ketchup, "A good deal of salt and spice is needed to keep the product well." At the end of the 17th century, Cheshire salt was still produced from 2 brine pits in Middlewich, one in Nantwich and one at Northwich. If a Chinese salt producer had gone to Cheshire in the 1500s, he would have been appalled by the primitiveness of the technology. Shirtless men climbed down ladders into the pits, filled leather buckets with brine, and climbed out to dump the brine in wooden troughs. Then a web of pipes and gutters channeled the brine to the many salt makers in the area. But by 1636, an account of a visit to the witches mentioned that pumps had just been installed in Nantwich to raise the brine. In the 18th century, life in England began to change. England experienced an extremely favorable shift in climate that allowed longer growing seasons and cheaper food. With food prices lowered, many English farms failed. Failed farms, in turn, created a workforce for industry. The English, before anyone else, believed industry was the answer to all problems. Agro-industry, which abandoned the goal of producing the best food and strived to produce the most per acre, was an English invention. Wheat crops increased enormously. New feed, such as turnips, kept livestock eating all year. Starting with Jethro Tull's seed-planting drill of 1701, which planted three rows at once, a new agricultural invention, a new crossbred plant, a new strain of livestock, or a new tool was invented almost every year in 18th century Britain. This was the beginning of modern agriculture, a system that would produce enormous surpluses of food in industrialized nations and still fail to end hunger in the world. These new developments in agriculture meant that food could be produced throughout the year, which meant less dependency on salt. Less salt seemed a modern idea, but salt production was increasing. Just as the Roman occupiers had run out of peat, English salt works were now running out of trees. The fuel which was heretofore used was all wood, which, since the ironworks is destroyed, that all the wood at any reasonable distance will not supply the works with one quarter of the year, so that now we use almost all pit coal which is brought to us by land from 13 or 14 miles difference. Dr. Thomas Rastell, Droitwich, 1678. By 1650 little was left of the forests of Cheshire. The lead pans by this time were each almost as big as a room and were installed on top of coal-fired furnaces. Hauling coal to Cheshire became a major expense of salt production. Saltmakers began to wonder if there might not be coal underneath Cheshire. They were surrounded by coal regions. In Whitehaven, not far north of them in Cumberland, and farther up near Glasgow at the mouth of the Clyde, salt was made and sold at a much lower price than Cheshire's product, because these salt works had their own coal fields. Elizabeth I, concerned about England's dependence on French salt, had guaranteed state-controlled markets to salt producers along the Tyne in Northumberland. She had chosen that region for stimulating production because it had coal for cheap fuel. Cheshire had salt, a river, and an Atlantic port. Its salt makers could have provided salt to a world in which British influence was rapidly expanding, if only they had cheap fuel. The Cheshire salt producers went coal prospecting. In 1670, John Jackson prospected for coal on the estate of William Marbury near Northwich, and at a depth of only 105 feet, found a bed of solid rock salt and no coal at all. The Royal Society published the news first with great excitement. Had Jackson discovered the source of underground brine? Was it a buried seabed? In 1682, John Collins wrote of Cheshire, "These springs being remote from the sea are conceived to arise from rocks, or mines of salt under the earth, the which are moistened by some channels or secret passages underground." But Marbury, disappointed that Jackson had found no coal, did not think to mine the rock salt and went bankrupt in 1690. In 1693, another Cheshire landowner, Sir Thomas Warburton, found rock salt under his estate, and 4 years later he owned one of four rock salt mines that opened in Cheshire. Rock salt did not need fuel. But the immediate reaction of the Cheshire brine boilers was to lobby Parliament for a bill banning the mining of rock salt. They believed that the discovery would change the nature of Cheshire, that the small-scale entrepreneur with a modest investment in a well and some lead pans would be pushed out by large and well-capitalized mining companies. But with the discovery